Association of New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Our guest today is an emeritus professor of geology and the former president of New Mexico Tech, Dr. Lawrence Lattman. And we're going to do something a little bit different today. I have reliable accounts of getting Professor Lattman to talk about the history of Western science is both entertaining and, for people like me, very informative. So that will be our show. Larry Lattman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
What I'd like to do is talk to you about the broad sweep of Western science, concentrating as much as we can on physics and math because of time constraints, and see if we can work our way up to the 1800s. All right?
That sounds good.
Okay, so let's start with where and when Western science begins.
Okay, like so much of Western anything, it started in ancient Athens. And the Greek islands in the Aegean, where the idea arose among some thinking people that it's possible to explain natural phenomena without invoking the many Greek gods. If a volcano erupted, it didn't have to be an angry god, or a big wave from the sea didn't have to be an angry god. There might, in fact, be an explanation. And so they developed ones who followed them, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, developed a whole method of reasoning called logic, inductive reasoning, deductive reasoning, the syllogism, and they used logic to explain things other than calling upon the gods to do it. And this was the beginning of science. What they did was made observations and then offered an explanation for the observations. The weakness is if the explanation was logical, it was assumed to be correct. Today we know that just being logical doesn't mean it's correct. At the same time, and somewhat afterward, a group of expatriates left Athens and moved down to Egypt, Thebes, Alexandria, and developed a very, very strong mathematical area there, the famous Pythagorean theorem, Euclidean geometry. A man named Eratosthenes looked at the time it took a sun to shine down a well, a water well, which meant the sun was directly overhead, then the amount of time it took to get to another well, a known distance away, and looked straight down it, knew the distance between them, figured from that, and since it took the sun 24 hours to get around the earth, he deduced that the earth was, we believed it to be round, of course, something of the order of what today we would call 20,000 miles, which wasn't too far off for the latitude of Egypt.
So all these things are sort of amazing, but what do you think is the – I mean, people had been making observations for a long time before the Greeks came up with, hey, these observations aren't necessarily the function of supernatural causes. What do you think it is about the Greeks or Greek culture that causes them all of a sudden to start thinking, hey, maybe it isn't the gods, it's something we can explain?
The respect for philosophy and human reasoning powers – and the logical power of the human mind, they respected it enormously, and they listened to what these people had to say. And in fact, as you know, Socrates faced exile or death for corrupting the Athenian youth because he was making them think. But thinking was a very popular thing in Greece, and the young Greeks were listening to Socrates, which frightened the old-timers. But the greatest by far of the ancient scientists was a man named Archimedes.
You know, all people disagree about all this, but I've heard Archimedes' name a lot.
Well, Archimedes was a mathematician and a physicist. He did many, many things, and he didn't do one thing, which the great mathematician Gauss thought was the greatest catastrophe in Western science. Archimedes, for example, understood the principle of the lever. He supposedly said, giving you a place to stand and a lever long enough and using the moon as a fulcrum, I could move the earth. They just didn't give him a lever long enough. He's the one, you remember, who determined whether the king of Syracuse's crown was pure gold by Archimedes' principle, ran through the streets of Syracuse yelling, "Eureka, I found it," etc. He is the man who held the Romans at bay when they assaulted the city of Syracuse in the 200s B.C. Their ships came up to the walls, and he threw rocks at them with catapults that were very, very accurate because he understood the principle of the pulley. He had very large catapults. He understood the mathematics of the parabola, and he launched these stones in such a way that the ships were battered. He supposedly got his troops or the Syracusan troops to polish their shields, formed them in the form of a concave mirror with many shields, and concentrated the sun's rays on the ships. In general, he drove the Romans nuts, and they retreated. One night when the Syracusans were celebrating their victory, the Romans, with the help of a traitor, came around the backside of the city, came into the city and took it over, and Marcellus, the Roman commander, said, "Whatever you do, find this guy Archimedes and bring him to us. I want him on our side. He is quite a catch." Unfortunately, the Roman soldier looking for him, when he found the old man drawing circles and triangles in the sand, said, "Come with me." And Archimedes said, "I'm too busy right now." The Roman soldier killed him. There's a tremendous parallelism in 200 BC between the Romans wanting to grab the scientist Archimedes for their side and the Americans, British, and Russians after World War II, who made a run for Peenemünde to grab the German rocket scientists who built the V-2 so we could have one too.
So you've described a lot of different things. And what period? It seems like we're talking about a long period of time, yeah, like 600 BC to like 200 BC.
That's correct. There's 700 years here.
Of development. And,
yes.
And during that same time, Rome becomes a power,
yes,
correct?
Yeah.
And when we think of Rome, we think of incredible engineering feats. We think of the aqueducts.
Exactly.
We think of roads.
Exactly.
But we don't think of science.
That's right. You're exactly correct.
So my question really is, how can that be? How can one culture be so advanced in some aspects but not in others?
The Romans were great conquerors. They were a militaristic society. The Roman Legion, of course, was the dominant military machine of its time and for years afterward. The Greeks were not. The Athenians were not primarily military people. The Spartans were, but not the Athenians. The Athenians had a lot of time to do science. The Romans were busy doing things, literally, conquering, moving. The roads were necessary to control the conquered areas. And the population of Rome grew so rapidly, the aqueducts were absolutely necessary to bring the water in. But so the Romans did not really concentrate on science. They applied it. They built Hadrian's Wall. They built ramps to attack Masada. They knew engineering, especially military applications, and that's what they concentrated on.
But the amazing thing about the Greeks is it's not only physics and math that you've talked about, but it's astronomy, it's zoology, it's botany, it's metallurgy. Okay. It's hard to imagine that all this stuff is happening 200 to 600 BC.
Don't forget the playwrights and the philosophers. The contributions of ancient Athens are totally stunning, no question. They were one of the high points of Western civilization. But let me point out the one thing that Archimedes did not do. He did not invent the decimal system, 0 to 9. You try and multiply 5 times 12 in Roman numerals and see what happens to you. Roman numerals are for counting, not for calculating. They couldn't calculate, although they understood geometry very well. Numerical calculation was almost completely beyond them. They could indeed count, but not perform mathematical operations, even though they understood the equation. The Diophantine equation existed. The decimal system was to come later by the back door, because when Rome fell, roughly the Western Roman Empire fell in the middle 5th century, 450 or so A.D., and the Dark Ages began, what was lost was what the Romans knew of the Greeks plus themselves, and the Dark Ages descended.
Well, let me just mention that if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're very pleased to have on the program today an emeritus professor and an emeritus president of New Mexico Tech, Dr. Larry Lattman. I've heard from some of Larry's students that if I can get Larry to talk about Western science, that it'll be both entertaining and informative, and that's what we're doing. And so you've just mentioned the fall of Rome, and we need to speed through the show in order to get to everything we want to get to. But what I've generally heard is that not much happens in science between, say, the fall of Rome in 450 A.D. and the Renaissance. Now, the Dark Ages has had sort of a resurgence. A lot of people say the Dark Ages aren't really the Dark Ages.
In science they were. What we worried about there were a number of angels that danced on the head of a pin and that type of stuff. But remember now, in the 600s, you have the origin and the spread of Islam. And Islam came across North Africa and into Spain, where they were called the Saracens, all the way up into the middle of France to 732 AD, when they finally were stopped at the Battle of Tours. But these Arabs who conquered northern France and Spain had on the other end to the east contact with India and contact through India to China. And from there they learned several things. One of them was the decimal system, which the Chinese apparently had 1,000 years B.C. We today still call the numbers 0 to 9 Arabic numerals because we learned them from the Arabs, but they learned it from the Hindus and the Chinese. Also, algebra, solving for – algebra is, in fact, an Arab word. Algebra is solving for unknowns, and the word is Arabic. So what science went on at all, in mathematics particularly, we got through the Arabs and their contact to the West. We developed none of our own.
So in the early Renaissance, now, what seems to happen, at least from my reading, is that what – in Europe, they kind of rediscover with the ancient Greeks. But when they rediscover the ancient Greeks, a lot of what they also rediscover are some of the weaknesses of the ancient Greeks, isn't it?
Yes.
And so you get this idea that, for example, that the sun is that the earth is the center of the universe instead of the sun.
Well, that's the Ptolemaic system of geometry and indeed of astronomy, sorry. And indeed, that was the belief that the earth was the center. And this accorded very well with the Old Testament, because God created the earth and then he put the rest of the things in the firmament. So the earth was the center and everything else was moving around it. And it made a lot of sense. The problem is that some of the so-called stars were not fixed. They were the planets, of course, seemed to be moving against the other stars, and they moved with a back-and-forth motion, which didn't make a lot of sense unless you put epicycles or circles on top of circles on top of circles, and it got so complicated that you could spend a lifetime trying to figure out what Ptolemaic astronomy was saying. Some real thinking on the part of some extraordinary people. One of the most famous, of course, was Copernicus, Johann Kepler, Tycho Brahe, a Danish astronomer, gradually put together the idea of the heliocentric system. The sun is the center of the solar system, and the earth is one of several planets rotating around it. And Kepler, in fact, derived laws of planetary motion on the relationship of the planetary orbits and their distance from the sun and the fact that the orbits were elliptical. This was the first breakthrough against a great major advance. It was in astronomy. And in fact, Copernicus didn't allow his work to be published until after he died, because he felt if it was published while he was still alive, he'd be burned at the stake. It was heresy.
Something like that happens to Galileo, right? Because Galileo supports Copernicus, and he is he's the subject of the Inquisition.
Yeah, Galileo is considered by some to be the father of physics. But people get this title, father.
There's a lot of fathers in
there. Yeah, right. Well, we didn't treat women very well in those days. They didn't have access to education. There's a very sad story about a female mathematician named Sophie Germain, and was unable to reach her full potential because she couldn't get the training she needed. She was a brilliant woman. In any event, Galileo was an extraordinarily brilliant guy, and he did many things. One of the things, he put the telescope, for example, on the sun, noticed the sunspots, and noticed they were moving, and came to the brilliant conclusion that the sun was rotating around its own axis, an almost impossible concept in any other type of astronomy but Copernican. Then he turned his telescope on Jupiter, and of course, found as a rudimentary telescope, he noticed the moons of Jupiter, the so-called Galilean moons, some of which were rotating opposite the way they should be. The idea that there was something rotating around the planets didn't fit with the Earth being the center of all rotation. Things were rotating around things other than the Earth all over the place. Then he did marvelous things. He deduced the law of the pendulum. He did that by sitting in the cathedral in Florence, and as the wind blew the cathedral through the cathedral, the chandeliers swung, and the chandeliers were of different length. And he timed the periodicity of the swinging of the chandeliers during the sermon, I guess, against his pulse, and deduced the law of the pendulum, the relationship between the arc of the pendulum and the... But he
so
did.
Do you buy the idea that all these people today are investment bankers?
Well, I tell you, most of them are not college presidents, that's for darn sure. But another thing he did, which was the great, when you get down to it, and it's very rarely mentioned, he made the statement that what's logical is not necessarily true. The first reference back to the Greeks, he said, look, you put an object on a table and you push it. And the harder you push it, the faster it goes, right? Right. Therefore, force is proportional to velocity, right? Or velocity proportional to force, right? Right. Wrong. Change of velocity or acceleration is proportional to force, not the velocity itself. What was absolutely logical, that velocity and force were directly proportional to each other, turned out to be wrong. Acceleration or change of velocity. This was monumental because for the first time it indicated that Greek science was not sufficient unto itself. We had to test the hypothesis. And the man who gets credit for really setting up the four steps of the scientific method, make the observations, come up with a theory to explain it. From that theory, deduce a new conclusion, and then go check that conclusion and see if the theory's right. Can it predict right? That man was a British or an English philosopher named Francis Bacon, who was very active at about this time. He's the one who said, I take all knowledge to be my province, a kind of modest statement, which today would get him probably locked up. But anyhow, there was a whole burst of great scientific activity at the time. Descartes, just a whole bunch of people coming up at the same time.
Pascal, the guy that sort of sends me, you know, I don't know if you have your favorite, but I guess maybe my favorite is Newton.
Who's that?
Newton.
Oh, well. Well, it's an idea. Galileo died to the day 1 year before Newton was born. Mm-hmm. Newton was born in 1642. Old style of dating, so they make it 1643 when they adjust the Julian calendar. But Newton was quite a character in many ways. He's considered by most scientists to be perhaps the greatest genius that ever lived because he was an experimentalist, he was a physicist, he was an astronomer. As somebody once told me, he demonstrated his overwhelming intelligence by remaining single all his life, but that gets me in trouble to say that. But Newton was kind of oddball, naturally, but he was a supreme mathematician, and he took the observations of Galileo and the observations of Kepler and the observations of Braille and constructed with his mathematical skill an entire system of the universe. He published a famous book, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, and the last book is The System of the World, using the law of the inverse squares and his own geometry. It was all geometry, which is I'll come back to in a moment. He was able to predict the tides with great accuracy, predict the motions of the planets. He literally created a system of the world. As Lagrange, a famous French astronomer later, said, he was the greatest genius ever lived, but also the luckiest because there was only one time that mathematics and physics can get together and harmoniously produce a complete explanation of natural phenomena, and Newton was the guy that did it. true.
Let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, and this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we were joined today by an emeritus professor and emeritus president of New Mexico Tech, and that's Dr. Larry Lattman. And Larry gives a lecture at in his geology classes that people tell me is a lot of fun and very informative, and it's about Western science. And so we asked Larry to come in and talk to us today about Western science, the history of Western science. And one of the things I read that actually surprised me was that Newton did tell people that a falling of an apple did actually stimulate him to think about gravity.
Well, that according to Gauss, who's the supreme mathematician, that's a not true story. It's apocryphal. He claims, Gauss, that some person who had no idea about all about what Newton was doing said, "How did you come up with this gravitational idea, Sir Isaac?" And Newton's thinking, "I've got to get rid of this guy." He said, "An apple fell and hit me on the nose." And the guy said, "Oh, that's great. I understand," and left. I don't know if that's true or not. What that apple story, the thing that's great about it is Newton came to the conclusion, whether an apple was involved or not, that the force which holds the planets in their motion around the sun is the same force that causes an apple to fall toward the Earth. Gravity is a universal force that holds the planets in their orbits and brings the moon in its orbit and causes objects to fall toward the Earth. And it varies as the inverse square of the distance between the objects. Newton died in
17... Yeah, and Newton, just to stay with that for one second, because one of the fascinating things that Newton comes up with is not only is the Earth attracting the moon, but the moon's attracting the Earth.
Oh, yeah, but the tides are due primarily to
exactly.
the moon, yeah.
And he comes up and he explains why it is that the moon circles the Earth and doesn't, say, fly off into space or come down. And what is that explanation?
Well, there is a force that tends to move the moon out, the centripetal force.
And that's just the speed.
Centrifugal, yeah. The object, if you spin something at the end of a string and let go of it, it's going to fly off into space.
Right.
Well, the moon would too, except something's holding it, gravity. Yeah. Centrifugal force would pull it out. But yeah, and they play against each other. The moon, however, is slowly falling toward the Earth. I wouldn't buy real estate based on that happening in your lifetime, but it's coming down the road. But he also, incidentally, in 1705, wrote a book, Optics, in which he studied light. He is the one who passed light through a prism and discovered it was made of many colors, then took all these colors and passed them through another prism and went back to white light. And we still talk about Newton's rings, which interference pattern. Newton did an excellent study, experimental. But the thing I want to point out to you is he had independently, along with a man named Leibniz in Germany, discovered the calculus, the most powerful mathematical tool we have, the language of science, as it's been called. He had the calculus, but he wrote the Principia, his great triple book, in geometry. And people thought, why? And the answer must have been because if he put it in calculus, none of his contemporaries could have understood it. So he did it in geometry, which is an exercise in mathematical skill that just takes your breath away. I mean, the geometry is, yeah, right. He was a very, very bright guy.
Yeah, and we haven't mentioned the laws of motion.
No. There's a whole whole system. That's a separate subject. But his impact was monumental. And, you know, people who didn't really understand what he did but saw the results, the British poet Alexander Pope made the statement, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light." And that's a poet talking about a mathematician, but it gives you an idea of the impact he had. He was buried in Westminster Abbey, which in those days was quite a deal, and because he was not nobility. He was very much recognized. He was a hero at his time.
Newton's investigations, his publications, all these things he comes up with, then are used for this burst of scientific activity in the 1800s. And I wonder if you could talk to us a bit about that.
Well, what happened is, he was followed by considerable mathematical development, a famous Swiss named Leonhard Euler, Lagrange, Laplace. Laplace did the Céleste Mécanique, the mechanical celestial mechanics. Gauss, probably the greatest pure mathematician, lived in 1777 to 1855. Monumental work. Now, what happened toward the beginning of the 17th century, about the time the end of Newton's life, the Industrial Revolution started in Britain. Machines took over from people. That's a separate subject. But then a bunch of sciences toward the end of the 1700s and early 1800s, Steve. Geology got its start through the work of a Scottish physician named James Hutton, who actually thought the Earth might be as much as 25,000 years old because it was thought to be only a few thousand. Today we figure it's 4.5 billion and nobody bats an eye. Chemistry, the phlogiston theory, which was all wrong, was destroyed by Lavoisier, the great French chemist who was later guillotined. That was in the 1780s. So chemistry got its start as an organized science. Physics got its start. We understood much.
And so it's essentially modern science that's getting its start at this time.
A start. And the physics that got a big start in the early 1800s through 1840, 1850 was electromagnetism, electricity. The whole idea of the electromagnetic field, that's how you got television today, and electricity, the invention of the electric motor and the generator. Men such as Oersted and Henry and Faraday and others. Finally, in 1865, a Scottish physicist, James Clerk Maxwell, developed the four equations of the electromagnetic field. And we began to have a problem, because at the same time, in the 1820s and 30s, a Russian named Lobachevsky was able to show that, forgetting the idea that Euclid, I argued that parallel lines do not meet ever, if you have them meet at infinity, you could do various other types of geometry. Non-Euclidean geometry was perfectly valid. It just wasn't Euclidean geometry, and it didn't fit the simple picture we have, yet was absolutely vital for Einstein's work later. And there was a tremendous burst of activity. In biology, you had Charles Darwin publish The Origin of Species in the 1850s with a whole idea that we don't pass on acquired characteristics. Bats are not blind because they got blind in the cave because they couldn't see. They didn't use their eyes. It's just that they were random. And the ones that happened to be born blind had no disadvantage and survived it. Survival of the fittest. The idea of inherited characteristics from our environment being passed on was not the answer. It was a random mutation pattern out of which nature selected the best. A whole Darwin concept, whether it's still accepted in all its manifestations, it isn't. The point is, a whole revolution occurred in biology and chemistry and electromagnetism. And it wasn't too much more than the early 1900s that a radio wave was sent from Ireland and Labrador, and we had wireless communication. And you know what that's done to us today.
Graham,
you're
going
to listen to it on radio. Exactly right.
And I'm afraid with that, we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
I would like to thank my guest today, Dr. Larry Lattman. Larry is the Emeritus Professor of Geology and the past president of New Mexico Tech. I would also like to thank my engineer today, Joe Green. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. Podcasts of this and other locally produced shows can be found at KUNM.org. Archives of my past shows can be found at the Spitz Report on the web. Thank you for listening. See you next time.